Good morning, and welcome to week two of Kosher Cops, the police ethics. And we're picking up from where we left off last week. We had started out by pointing out the problem and the challenge involved in police work, where we noted the speech by Chief of Police Ramsey from the Washington, D.C. Chief of Police, where he talked about the role that police played in supporting the Nazis and carrying out their work during the Holocaust, and the problem of fundamentally placing police in the position of having power, being able to wield that power over the population. But on the other hand, you need police. If you don't have that most basic system of law enforcement, how is society going to manage it all? And that's something that we developed somewhat last week. I gave you, at the time, paragraph 18 of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Act, the federal act. I did note in my follow-up email from the class the text of the Comprehensive Ontario Police Services Act, which is a little bit broader in some of the roles of the police. For those who didn't notice the follow-up email, it says there that the job of the police is to preserve the peace, which was the same as the Mounties, preventing crime, assisting others in preventing crime, also same, assisting victims of crime, which interestingly was not in the RCMP job description. For some reason, it's in one and not in the other. Laying charges and participating in prosecution of crime, which I don't think was in the RCMP job description either, which is very interesting. And executing the warrants, which we did have in both. But fundamentally, their role is support services for government and to ensure that the law is followed. And preserving the peace is, I guess, a second piece of that, which we have to come back to, which is also maintaining peace within society. So we also talked about the Jewish law description of the role of police, punishing at the judge's instruction, arresting a flight risk. We talked about the biblical cases of that, enforcing Jewish law, getting people to fulfill their religious obligations. We talked about it in terms of municipal regulations as well, so they circulate and make sure that the weights and measures are honest in the stores. And that brings us to where we start this morning, where what I want to do is, as I said in the email when I sent out the source sheet, I want to take the problem further and talk about the fact that on the one hand, from a Jewish perspective, it's obligatory to set up such a police force. It's actually a requirement of society. Not only is it a practical need, but it's part of Jewish law. And at the same time, the things a police officer does, if they're not justified, actually run afoul of Jewish law, are considered to be in violation of Jewish law. And we're going to go role by role in terms of what the police do to show that. And that will lead to what I think is a solution found within Jewish law, the approach of Jewish law that tries to address this. I am going to note now, thank you for reminding me, please make sure to silence your phones. Thanks. Forgot that in the beginning. But how does Jewish law try to prevent this situation? And I want to apply the solution, if we get that far, we'll see. I want to apply the solution to the problem that Jonathan mentioned last week, which is the balance of preserving the law and preserving the peace. The situation that police sometimes find themselves in which, if they're going to arrest those who should be arrested, they run the risk of serious public problems. This morning, you mentioned to me the Via Rail protests as an example of that potentially, but it's one that comes up all the time in a variety of circumstances. And so I'd like to be able to get to that and say, so what would Jewish law say? What do you do when, on the one hand, the law is being broken, but on the other hand, you're afraid that if you enforce the law, you're going to run afoul of other problems and potentially even make things worse. So going back to where I said we would start today, which is the obligation to set up a police force. So you could look at it within Judaism as a right. Society has a right to do it, but they could choose not to do it. In the book of Shmuel, the book of Samuel, we are introduced to Jewish monarchy. Who is the first monarch? Saul, right? Shaul, King Saul. Technically, there are elements of monarchy found already in Moshe and Moses, but the first formal king, and I define king not only by the powers wielded by the king, but by the fact that authority is hereditary. So that it's going to be passed down to the next in line. That's something that begins with Shaul HaMelech, with King Saul. Interestingly, beyond the scope of what we're going to get into in our discussion, but worth recognizing, even though the Torah says, when you come into your land and you say, I want to have a king, you shall, and here are the rules that the king is going to follow, when the Jews actually request a king, when they approach Samuel, who is their prophet and their judge, and they say to him, we want a king, his reaction is harsh. He says, absolutely not. This is a terrible idea. And God says to him, classic response from God, God says, don't worry about it. It's not you, it's me. That's what God says to him. They're not rebelling against you, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. And it's going to be okay. And so he ends up appointing Shaul, appointing Saul as king. But before he does that, he gives a speech to the people about what's called in Hebrew, Mishpitei HaMelucha, the laws of the monarchy. Meaning, what the powers are that a king has. And he says, the king is able to take your property. The king is able to take your children and have them work in his service. The king is able to do basically anything and everything he wants. And there's a debate, rabbinically, about whether he was serious, like, yes, that's actually what kings are allowed to do, or whether he was predicting the disaster that would unfold in the careers of various Jewish kings where they would do these things. Not because they're allowed to do it, but because they can get away with it. So that's its own discussion. However, this concept of the powers of the king is a really interesting concept, because the truth is, when the biblical law first presents the laws of the king, it doesn't mention anything about powers of a king. When the Torah first speaks about it, I think it's Deuteronomy chapter 17, when it speaks about the laws of a king, anybody know any of those laws that are mentioned? Right? He's not allowed to have too many horses. He's not allowed to have too many wives. Those are two separate sentences. Just saying, you know, you put these things together, you get in trouble. He has to write a Torah and keep it with him at all times. And actually, he ends up with two Torahs, because there's a general mitzvah for everyone to have a Torah, and then the king's got to have an extra one. And the other one is not too much gold. He's not supposed to have too much gold and silver. Those are the restrictions on a king, and those are the laws that are presented. I mean, the Torah never says, and kings can do this and kings can do that. It doesn't give you that. It only gives you the prohibitions. It gives you the restrictions, what a king is not supposed to do. So where did these powers come from that a king is able to wield? Where is the authority of taxation? Why are kings able to do that? So if you take a look at source number one, Rabbeinu Nissim, a rabbi in 14th century Spain, did a lot of work on the issue of political power and where it comes from and where it goes. And he says, I only brought you a piece of what is much longer. He says, when Israel has a Sanhedrin, a high court, and king, the Sanhedrin only judges the nation justly, not exceeding this mandate to improve the nation's affairs unless the king empowers them. In other words, the high court, and clearly its subsidiary courts, are only authorized to carry out the law. Case comes up, guilty, innocent, whatever it is, they judge the case. No extrajudicial authority is invested in them. The king is the one who has that power. But when there is no king in Israel, the judge, in quotes, incorporates two powers. The powers of the judge and the powers of the king. In other words, the authority vested in a king is not a function of being a king at all. Rather, as he goes on to explain, the nation as a whole has certain powers. We today, in Canada, in the year 2020, will recognize this as democracy, fundamentally. There are powers that are invested in the population as a whole. When a king is selected, those powers are handed over, essentially, to the king as the head of the government. However, much work has been done, there's a lot of literature, rabbinic literature, on this issue, demonstrating that if the society chooses instead to elect somebody, if it's a democratic system, then that power may well go to the elected representative of the population. The people have chosen to assign their authority to the leader they have selected. But going back to the point for us, the word judge is in quotation marks here because it isn't only about the judge. It will go into the hands of law enforcement, which will include the police. Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook wrote about this concept, the idea that the powers are really powers of the population, and he noted that this happened in Jewish history, that even after we didn't have after we stopped having kings who were appointed with prophets empowering them and so on, you had people who wielded these powers. You had the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, who fought off the Greeks and indeed ran themselves like a monarchy until they ran themselves into the ground. And then you had in the post-biblical period, you had the Reish Galuta, the leader of the Jews who were in exile, the Nasi, leader of the Jews who were in Israel. Within this school of thought, there's a set of powers, the nation has it, and they can choose to assign it to leaders. However, the stronger view is that it's not just a right for society, but it's actually a religious responsibility for society. That they have to create law, and they have to carry out law. Can anyone suggest to me what this would mean? What does that mean when you say that there's a religious law? What law in the Torah might require society to create a police force, to have law enforcement? Where would this come from? Well, Lo Tirtzach means don't commit murder. So there are a couple of different ways I could take what Eti is saying. Eti points out that Torah has rules like do not commit murder. Inherent in that rule is, and if somebody does, you got to do something about it. Or you need the means of preventing it. So I'm going to take that in a couple of different ways, but I'm going to take that actually next. I'm going to first suggest something else. Take a look at source number 2. A passage from the Talmud speaks about the responsibilities of the courts. And when it says the responsibility of the court, I don't envision a rabbinical court walking around doing this as much as it's the agents whom they appoint who go around doing the following. The courts go to dethorn paths. In other words, they have to walk along the roads. Right? After winter is over and they need to clear things out, or maybe when things are growing during the summer, they clear off the thorns that could entangle people. They have to fix up the roads and the plazas. They measure the mikvaot, right? The mikvah that's used for tahara, for purification purposes. They measure them and make sure they have enough water. And how do we know that if they fail to do this, they are biblically liable for any blood which is spilled? As though they had done it, as though they had spilled the blood themselves. Because a verse in Deuteronomy says, innocent blood shall not be shed in your land, ... and the blood will be on your head. The blood is on the head of the authorities. The biblical Hebrew is v'haya alecha damim. It is on their head. In other words, there is a basic responsibility for public safety. That's number one. And therefore you need laws, and therefore you need law enforcement. It's about protecting people from harm. That's number one. Number two, going more towards where Ethi was going with this, it's inherent in justice that there will be law enforcement. Because if you don't have teeth, it ain't going to happen. Right? Take a look, please, at source number 3, where the Midrash actually says that explicitly. This source goes back to, well, Rabbi Elazar would have been, I believe, somewhere 1,500 years ago. Rabbi Elazar said, if there is no shoter, there is no judge. Right? Remember we defined shoter last week. Shoter in modern Hebrew is a term we use for the police officer, mishtara, but it comes from a term meaning authority. If there is no shoter, there is no judge. How so? A person is found in court to owe someone else. If there is no shoter to produce payment from him, then once he leaves the court, the judge will have no means to affect him. Unless he turns the person over to a shoter, and the shoter will produce it from him. Right? Realistically, the judge can say, you owe, but lots of luck carrying it out. You need to to have teeth, someone's going to have to enforce it. And based on that, take a look at number four. Right, Moses Maimonides, in the very beginning of his Laws of Courts, says, there is a biblical command to appoint judges and officers in every land and area. As it is written, Shoftim are the judges who are fixed in court with litigants coming before them. Shotrim, the shoter, which is plural, are the wielders of the staff and lash. They stand before the judges, they circulate in the markets and streets and stores to fix the prices and measures, we talked about that last week, to strike all who are corrupt. All of their deeds are at the word of the judges, and when they see impropriety in a person, they bring him to court and judge him according to his wickedness. In other words, they arrest people and bring them before the court.
Okay,
Betty.
So what if the police are the one they injure?
So that's where we're going. Yeah, that's where we're going, because we have the other, we have the problem of abuse of power. But first we have to talk about the obligation to wield it at all.
What about when the police are ordered to wield power and they don't?
Also an issue which we're going to get to. Linda.
What kind of laws are you talking about?
Good. So inherent in a command that says that we're responsible for public safety is the idea that it's not sufficient to have the laws that are presented in the Torah. Meaning, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet talked about this back in the 13th, 14th century in Spain. He said, it's not realistic to expect a society to govern itself, and particularly in the area of public safety, based just on the laws found in the Torah. The Torah does not have any rules about traffic. Right? I mean, other than be nice to each other, which can go a long way. But you don't have stop signs, you don't have traffic lights, you don't have bike lanes, none of that's there. What is expected is that a command like this that says, ensure that people are safe, will be taken as a basis for creating laws so that people will be safe, and then the courts are responsible not only for taking care of the laws that are the basic ones written into the Torah, but also their applications, like the traffic laws. So the courts are going to be responsible for not only the straight laws of the Torah, but also for all of these different supportive systems that have to be created in order to manage society. It actually... So the courts are going to be responsible for that as well. That's correct.
For what?
Ritual law. Like we talked about last week when we said that one of the roles of the court is to enforce religious law. Right? The person says, I don't want to get a lulav, right, for Sukkot. The court may well step in. This is classic courts. We talked about the fact that you don't have ordination and you don't have true true authority like that post-5th century. But that's the idea. So that, yes, the courts are going to be responsible for all of the above. Jonathan?
I think you said in the very beginning that the appointing of a king was against God rather than against Samuel. But why is it against God? I don't understand.
So I didn't want to go into this too much, but I'll go into it a little bit. Why is it that Samuel is so angry, and why is it that God says it's about me when they demand to have a king? So Samuel sees it as an offense against him because he is currently their king, so to speak. Right? He is now in charge. If people have issues, if people have problems, they're supposed to go to him, and he is the shofet. He is the judge. People are coming to him during his career and saying to him, actually, we think we'd like to have somebody else. It's a little offensive. God's response, though, is, it's not about you. What it's about is your role. Because what the people requested was a king who would judge them like everybody else, meaning like all the other nations, and specifically as Rabbeinu Nissim, who I quoted in number one, as he explains the issue, he says, the people don't want a system in which you have a prophet who is getting a message from God and applying it, who is looking to God's law and saying, this is how I'm going to judge cases. What they want is a king who's going to make it up himself. Because that's the way it normally works. Human beings create their systems of government. And that's what the people are resisting here. And so God says, it's really about me. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to appoint a king who's going to listen to prophets. And that works sometimes, and it doesn't work at other times, but that's the suggested model. For those who go to my Thursday afternoon class in Thornhill on the book of Shmuel, the book of Samuel, this is a review. There we discussed it at much greater length. So you have two mandates so far, religiously, for creating law enforcement. Number one is protection of public safety, and number two is part of carrying out justice. There's also a third element, which is the most purely religious out of the three. There's a verse which appears repeatedly, or a piece of a verse, really, that appears repeatedly in the book of Devarim, in the book of Deuteronomy. And it goes in Hebrew, Uvi'arta hara mikirbecha. Uvi'arta, I'll say. Mavir, you could suggest, for another way to form the verb. Sorry? Well, that's my question, is what exactly does it mean? It doesn't mean purify. My Hebrew speakers, Leva'er, what? With an ayin. We do before Passover, Biur Chametz. Some people think burn. So that's actually a debate as to whether it means to burn or to consume. But either way, it is an eradication that's going on, fundamentally. Uvi'arta hara mikirbecha, there is a religious mandate of eliminate evil from your midst. So one example of that in Deuteronomy is human trafficking. If somebody kidnaps somebody else and sells them, so the Torah says, Uvi'arta hara mikirbecha, you shall eliminate evil from your midst. There's a range. It appears that line or some version of it appears six or seven times in the book of Deuteronomy. So the one I just mentioned is chapter 24, sentence 7. I wrote that in my notes. I didn't know that by heart. But this obligation is not just a society-level obligation. It exists on an individual level. I quoted this in a session for accountants the other day on whistleblowing. I need to give a little bit of background for it, though. You may be familiar with the rule that a rabbinical court requires two witnesses to act as a set in order to testify that an event took place. There are two different types of testimony. There's testimony about an object, the nature of an object, and then there's testimony about an event. We saw such and such happen. The two witnesses are considered a set, such that if it turns out they're related to each other, the set is disqualified. It's thrown out. Well, the question is, how do you become a set of witnesses? Meaning, what if I go to a hockey game and I happen to have my brother with me at the game and we're sitting side by side and we witness a crime? The Leafs win. No, we witness a crime. So are we by definition a set such that we now can't testify? Is that what you're going to tell me, that we're now disqualified? Or do you only become a set when you walk into court together and say, we're going to testify together? But otherwise, we could just, you know, find some third person who also saw it, then one of us will testify with that other person who's not related to us. So that's a discussion in the Talmud. And at one point, the suggestion is made that if you witness the event, you see the event with somebody else, you are automatically a set. And the Talmud asks, well, then what should two brothers do? If they witness a murder together, what are they supposed to do now? So your answer could have been, all right, so go home. That's it. You're out of luck. But the Talmud clearly doesn't accept that. It sees it as an imperative. Rabbeinu Asher, a writer in Jewish law, you can see it here, number 5, comments on that. He says, anyone who sees impropriety is obligated to testify, fulfilling that verse I've mentioned, you shall eradicate evil from your midst. There is a duty of eliminating that which is evil. So that's your third source for saying we have to set up law enforcement, and law enforcement with teeth. Public safety, that's as a social matter. It's about carrying out justice. And it's about eliminating evil. You could argue that there's overlap between them. I'm not hung up on there being three, but I like sets of three. They work. And I think there is some distinction to be drawn. But what emerges now is, I have to have a police department, and I have to enter into the risk that they're going to abuse their power. And now let's talk more about that abuse of power. Police are indeed empowered, we've seen it already, to strike people, to harm people. Look at source number 6. Betty, you've been waiting for this one since last week. The Tosefta in Baba Kama. The Tosefta, just for those who may be familiar with the term Tosefta, we've talked about in years past. The Talmud is a record of verbal discussions of Jewish law, Jewish ethics, Jewish thought, that took place over the span of centuries and centuries. They wrote down the first version of it as the Mishnah, a basic outline of law that was concluded in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era. It was not supposed to be written down, but they decided that it was necessary because of a variety of factors that basically include persecution and forgetting, the two going hand in hand. And then they realized that wasn't sufficient, and they wrote down more of the discussions in what was known as the Gemara. Together they formed the Talmud. The Gemara, the Babylonian one, is concluded in the middle of the 6th century Common Era. However, when the decision is made of what to canonize in the Mishnah, there's stuff that's in, and then there's stuff that is out. So some sages went, at the same time that all of this was going on, and collected some of the texts that had been omitted from the Mishnah. Some of which was omitted because it was considered to be redundant. Yeah, we already got it in the Mishnah. Some of it because its authorship was suspect. It wasn't clear maybe that it had the same authority as that which made it into the Mishnah. And some of it was left out because those who were canonizing the Mishnah didn't have access to it. Something could have been written a little bit later than their work, that sort of thing. And so they collected these texts which were contemporary to the Mishnah and canonized them in what's called the Tosefta. Tosefta from the word Tosefet, addition, when you add it to something, because it's extra text. So what that means is you're reading something that was authored by people a couple of thousand years ago, although it was collected slightly after the Mishnah was collected, somewhere around the 4th century Common Era, we'll call it. End of the 3rd century, beginning of the 4th century. Okay, so look at this line. If the court agent, that's what we're referring to the police officer right now, strikes with their authority, meaning they told him, this is what you're supposed to do, they had corporal punishment, and causes harm, he's exempt from liability. That was the point. If he is excessive, though, if he goes beyond what he's authorized to do, then he is liable. There is no indemnification. There's no statement of, well, if you're a police officer, what you do is okay. It doesn't work that way. There is indeed liability if he does more than what he was supposed to do. Not only that, sorry. The court itself. Meaning, the instructions of the court have to be given in a very clear way. It's not as though they can be vague about what's supposed to be done. And classically, they were done in a very clear way. Meaning, the basic example would be lashes. So you may be familiar with the fact that biblically, if a person violates certain crimes, they may be subject to lashes in court. Now, it's hard in general to carry out corporal punishment in Jewish law. It requires testimony, cross-examination. It's really hard to end up carrying out these punishments. Nonetheless, let's say that happened. The lashes are administered in sets of 3, with evaluation by an on-site physician to make sure that the person is actually able to bear it. In the event that the physician says, enough, the goal is not to kill them, the goal is not to maim them, then at that point they stop. There's more to be said about this, but not right now. But yes, they have to be very clear about the instruction that they're giving. So, number one, the police themselves are bound to follow the rules of the court and will be held responsible in the event that they exceed their mandate. But it's not just about corporal punishment. Imprisonment also is something that is not really accepted in Jewish law. This is something I want to come back to next week. But Rabbi Chaim David Halevi was a leading rabbi in Israel in the middle of the 20th century. I think he passed away in the 70s. And he wrote a work called Onesh HaMa'asar BaHalakha, which means the punishment of imprisonment in Jewish law. And take a look at what he said here in source number 7 in that piece. He says, God who shows the way for penitence, it's in quotes because that's actually a verse, but God who shows the way for penitence after they descend into the world of sin did not choose to punish them with imprisonment. The meaning, there is no line in the Torah that says, did this crime? Go to jail. He is good and just. Although imprisonment seems righteous and just, it certainly is not good. Not in itself, because it involves removing human liberty, and not in its results. He says, imprisonment by definition is not going to be something that is going to be beneficial. And of course, there's a lot of discussion about this nowadays in terms of imprisonment and whether it has any rehabilitative possibility or whether it's just punitive. But he was very against the concept of imprisonment. Now, the truth is, you could argue against him. Where is there a biblical example of imprisonment? Sorry? Well, Joseph wasn't a good one. That's the Egyptian model. We're not endorsing that. The cities of refuge would be the question. If somebody commits murder accidentally, so the rule is they go to the city of refuge, and they stay there until the high priest dies, and at that point they are freed from it. So is that, in fact, a case of imprisonment? Mind you, it was a city. There were no walls around it keeping them in. They chose to stay there, and I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But it was a city. You had businesses, you had schools, you had everything there. And that's where I was going with the fact that there are no walls. As Linda notes, the other way to look at it is, or a second way to look at it is, that it's actually intended to protect the person from the relatives of the victim. And there's even a third perspective, which is that it's actually a rehabilitative experience, in the sense that these cities of refuge were the cities of the Levites. They were taken from the cities of the Leviim. And the Levites, when they're not working in the temple, have the job of educating people. And so, while we don't have any real description of how these cities ran, the Talmud does not take time to describe what actually life looked like. You could envision that alongside their general life experience that they're having there in the city, their work, their family, whatever it is that they're doing there, because family could move in with them, they also had some kind of mandatory educational program about the carelessness that had led to the murder. There's more to be said about that at another point. Right now, we're going to stick closer to what we have here. But this underscores the importance of people's freedom. So if we're going to empower law enforcement to imprison people, we have to recognize that we're actually going against what Rabbi Chaim David Halevi calls the spirit of what the Torah wants. Not only that, when it comes to law enforcement may need to do things in order to gain information. What sorts of things does law enforcement do in order to find out about crimes that have been committed? Or will be committed, for that matter. Sorry?
Wiretapping?
Sorry?
Cameras.
Waterboarding.
I can't hear you.
Cameras.
So waterboarding, I think, is generally not a police issue. It's a military issue, as far as I understand. But yes, the issues of invasion of people's privacy, which is the sorry. Right, so there's the problem of interrogation as well. That goes back under striking people as a problem. But in terms of the means they have of investigating and gaining information, this is a very serious issue of invading privacy. In Jewish law, we are very, very clear about the prohibitions against invading somebody's privacy. There's a biblical prohibition against rechilut. Rechilut means gossip, tale-bearing. Which is not a case of lying about somebody. It's about telling the truth. And it's not about spreading harmful speech about someone. That's also prohibited. It's even if the information isn't negative. It's not for me to spread information about somebody else. There are exceptions, obviously, where, for the sake of the public welfare, people need to know. So if somebody in a community develops coronavirus, then, yeah, I think you have to inform the community so that people who interacted with them will be aware. God forbid, somebody loses a relative, so they want people to know and come to the funeral. You don't want to put the onus on the family to be the ones to have to inform everybody. So in a normal situation, you'd also say, so spread that information. There are times when it's important to let people know things. But as a general rule, it's prohibited to share information about people with others, and then certainly to go looking for that information in the first place, invading somebody's privacy. Take a look at source number 8. I brought you just one writer on this. I could have brought you 70. Rabbi Yosef Chagiz in Morocco. It appears that one may not seek out another person's secrets. What's the difference between gossip about others and about one's self? Meaning, if you read someone's letter, right, you're effectively turning them into a gossip about themselves, so to speak. Not that they're guilty of anything, you read their letter, but you're having them, instead of having a conversation at the water cooler about a third party, now you're making the person tell you themselves about themselves by reading their letters, is the case that he's talking about. So if they choose to put it online, that's their decision. But if they think that what they're doing is private, and then you read it, you have a problem, right? This comes up all the time. Somebody forwards you an email, right, from somebody else. Somebody accidentally sends you an email when they were trying to send it to somebody else. Somebody wants to send you an email about something, but they inadvertently included a chain of stuff below. You're not allowed to read those things. That's actually halachically prohibited.
There's a disclaimer at the bottom of these. Is that this, if you're not the recipient, the intended recipient, is that binding? Do not read this and discard it.
So from Jewish law, from secular law, I can't speak to that. I'll let the lawyer speak to that. But from Jewish law, it's absolutely 100% binding. Not allowed to read that. Someone sends you something by mistake, the answer is delete it. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
There was a case of, there was a basketball owner, I think, who said something racist, but in private.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, all kinds of things happened.
Yeah.
And
I remember the story. So the answer is that you're not allowed to disclose someone else's information. You know, there's, because you mentioned, you know, a case like that, there is a sense of righteousness / self-righteousness within society that when somebody does something wrong, then of course we should publicize it and promote it. But I don't think that's necessarily true. When it comes to protecting people from harm, that's one thing. Meaning, if somebody discloses in private information which in fact could involve harm for others, and you can protect others by telling them, then you may need to act with rules about it. I mean, that was my class for accountants on Sunday morning, was about whistleblowing. And when it's appropriate to do so from a CPA Ontario perspective and from a Jewish law perspective.
Wait, so just to be clear, so if somebody makes in a position of power-ish, make some racist comments and you overhear it, you're not supposed to be the whistleblower on this person?
If there's a sense that this reflects a bigger problem, such that people are in danger because of them, they're in a position of power over others, and if, you know, and this legitimately could reflect an attitude, a behavior, you know, that can harm others, then you're in a different league. Then it's a different story. But if it's just somebody who is, I don't want to use adjectives. I'm just going to leave it. If it's just somebody who is morally questionable, you know, then I'm not going to, you know, I don't think it's justified. I think you have to always know where, you know, how things move from being morally questionable to being dangerous to other people. And I think that's where we draw the line. Yeah. Eddie.
You sent me an email, okay?
Yes.
And you meant it for
Yes. Right, so, yes, and clear, and, right, and the answer is that that's true. Obviously, you have to, you can't be guilty of reading someone else's email unless you know it's someone else's email. That is true. I had it happen the other day. I mean, it was a fairly innocent thing. I had somebody who wanted to send an email to somebody named Mordechai, and the email began, "Hi, Mordechai," and so on. And then I realized as they're reading it that it clearly was a different Mordechai, but they must have had, you know, autocomplete or whatever it was. And so it sent it to me instead of them. So you just respond to the person and say, "I don't think this is for me." It happens. This is the way it goes. One other point within this, we talk about police, law enforcement, needing to invade people's property, right? They need to arrest somebody. So people should be aware that invading property also is a violation of Jewish law. Take a look at source number 9. This is a classic. "One may not stand at a window and look into another person's yard, lest he cause harm with his sight." It's called in the terms of the Talmud, Hezek Re'ia. This is prohibited. How do you cause harm by seeing something? What does that mean? So one view is that it's a gossip issue. In other words, you learn what's going on in their property. Another view is that this could be related to ayin hara. You're jealous of what you see. That sparks something. We've discussed that in other series. I'm not going to go over ayin hara right now. Another view is simply that if somebody knows that they can be observed in their property, then that diminishes their use of the property because they'll know they can't do certain things because they can be watched. So you're damaging their property in that sense. So all these things, sorry? Yes. All these things that police are supposed to do as part of their job description, ranging from physical harm to arresting people to wiretapping and other invasions of privacy to literally invading someone's physical property. These are all things which, if you're not doing it within the proper command of the judge dealing with things properly, are direct violations of Jewish law. So we're really setting up a serious problem, because what we've now said is that on the one hand, we're obligated to set up law enforcement to give them all of these tools. And on the other hand, we're saying, but if you use them incorrectly, you've now broken the law. So we're creating a problem. But Janice.
Well, but if you look into somebody's yard and you see something that is dangerous to another person, either on that property or...
Right.
Is your obligation to inform the police or to go by this, that
right.
You should not?
Right. So in the event that you possess information... We don't have the, in the U.S., this is one of those issues in the Bill of Rights about information obtained inappropriately and whether it can be used against somebody. But on a basic level, if you have information that is needed, you know, in order to protect somebody from harm, you will have to find a way to convey that information such that people will be protected from harm. That doesn't change the fact that what you did was wrong. But you're under a new set of circumstances now, and you have a duty to protect people from harm. Yeah.
This will be a separate lecture, possibly, but a brief comment about paparazzi.
No, thanks. No, thanks.
How they fit in here, their invasion.
I mean, yeah, no, all of those things, I think, are repellent. Sorry.
No further discussion.
Yeah. Let's move into the solution then. What does Jewish law put forth as the way to deal with this? And it's really a fairly straightforward approach. I think everybody here probably, you know, knows what I'm going to say with it, but I think it's a serious approach to the problem. This is about mindset and mechanics, as I put on the sheet. First of all, mindset. The mindset of the police has to be, we are doing this as a religious duty, right? Remember that Chief of Police Ramsey said that they should view themselves as agents of the population, not agents of the government. He said they should see themselves as working for the people. And while that was a very nice idea that he put forth, the weakness of it was, but you're not. You're really an agent of the government. You may have the good of the people in mind, but your boss is the government. So what Judaism is proposing is that you are actually an agent not of the people, not of the government to whom you report. You're an agent of God. It's a religious obligation. That's where the police have to look at it. Just like those religious duties that we outlined already, whether it's public safety, justice, eradicating evil, that's the role. Police are often described in Hebrew as shaliach beit din, an agent of the rabbinical court. This was clear in Maimonides in source number 4, when he talked about how the shoter has to rely on judicial approval for whatever it is that this shoter is going to do. That's the mindset. The mentality is, this is a religious duty that we're carrying out, and then the mechanics of it are that you have to impose oversight and you have to impose training in order to prevent error beforehand or to punish it when it happens, so that the judges are overseeing them. But as Rabbi Chaim David Halevi writes, the police actually had a training program. There was a certification process in order to avoid harming an innocent person accidentally. Rabbi Elio Kramer, in 18th century Lithuania, better known as, anybody know who Rabbi Elio Kramer was? He has another name, but more people know him by the other name. The Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon, or the Gaon of Vilna, if you will. He was considered to be one of the greatest Jewish minds of that period, and frankly periods thereafter. So he has a biblical comment when the Jews establish their hierarchy of courts, right? Remember, it's actually this week's Torah portion, the portion of Yitro, right? Moshe's father-in-law visits him, sees him managing the nation's affairs all day long, and says to him, you need to delegate. You got to delegate. And so they end up with this system of Sarei Alafim, Sarei Meot, Sarei Hamishim, Sarei Asarot. Literally, officers of thousands, officers of hundreds, officers of fifties, officers of tens. And what that means is that you have a high-level court that's responsible for a jurisdiction that encompasses 1,000 people, or 1,000 families, unclear. Then you have the next layer down, 100, next layer down, 50, next layer down, you have people who are in charge of just 10. So Rabbi Elio of Vilna comments when this actually appears twice in the Torah, once in this week's Torah portion, and again in the book of Deuteronomy, the beginning of the book, he comments in the Deuteronomy passage, I didn't bring it on the sheet, that the officers of tens actually includes the shodrim. That includes these enforcers of the law. Well, when you look at what was required when they hired these people for the job, when you look at the biblical description, they have to be people who are known as being of high character, and there's a training element that also goes into it. These had to be people of unique standing. So that's the way that this is supposed to work, meaning to recognize we're creating a problem. We're creating a system in which people have powers that can be used to break the law, but at the same time they are religiously necessary. But what we're going to do is put them not under a general office of the police, but rather view them as part of a religious structure and responsible to it. And the hope is that that's going to help to keep them in line. Obviously, it doesn't always work. If it did, you wouldn't need lines like that Tosefta that we talked about. What if they didn't do what they were supposed to do? But that's the idea. Are we clear? Okay. I want to apply that to Jonathan's question from last week. He pointed out again the challenge of police who choose to preserve the peace over preserving the law. So they want to avoid a riot at the expense of victims of crime. We're not going to prosecute, because if we did, then that would cause greater disturbances. It would cause greater resistance. It's a real challenge, because it's true. Sometimes enforcing the law leads to a loss of community support for law enforcement. All right, I brought you a paper. Look at number 11. I'm skipping number 10. Take a look at number 11, please. From the Rutgers Law Review in 1968, arrests and civil disturbances, right? That was a good time to write articles about this. Although, frankly, you could have just as easily written it in Los Angeles in the 1980s. You could just as easily have written it any time in the last 10 years, anywhere in North America. It is critical to distinguish mass breakdown in respect for and fear of the law from isolated single transgressions. He says you have to distinguish between where just this community of people no longer respects the law and when somebody, you know, shoplifts from a store. Police have hitherto been trained to operate in a context in which the lawbreaker stands not only opposed to the law enforcement authority, but to the community itself. Meaning, the normal case of crime, anybody who reads about that crime is going to be angry that, hey, somebody broke the law, and is going to side with law enforcement against the criminal. That's what we think of as the standard case of crime. In such situations, the police can rely at least upon the passivity of the community, if not upon its cooperation in the criminal's apprehension. At least people aren't going to block the police from acting. Deadly force used against a lone felon may even evoke approval of citizens bred in a cops and robbers culture. Deadly force used against large numbers of citizens who just prior to the riots were for the most part law-abiding and peaceful can have crushing social consequences, right? On the other hand, if what you're talking about are people who generally are law-abiding, but they get caught up in a particular event, if you try to enforce the law the same way, you may indeed have what he calls crushing social consequences, loss of faith from the community. And when you think about the Rodney King case as an example, or some of the stuff over the last several years, in which there were predictions of if they convict or if the police act, then there are going to be riots, you find exactly this problem, and it becomes easier to overlook things. Is everyone clear on what I'm putting forward? Yeah.
I'm just thinking back a few years in Toronto. I think it was the G20 they were meeting. They're arresting everyone.
Right. Yeah. Right. And the reports afterwards and the investigation afterwards was there's an awful lot of impropriety that went into that.
Yeah.
A good example of it. I know now I've been in Toronto for a while because people are referring to things from a few years ago and I remember them. But where is Judaism going to fall out on this? So I'm not sure this will be a popular position, but I think it's the realistic position within what Judaism says, is that the Torah and the Talmud argue on behalf of law enforcement, including in cases where there could be pushback. Because of the idea that justice is fundamentally a religious obligation, it's something that's coming from God. Take a look at source number 12. Instructions that are given to judges and therefore to their police enforcement as well. The Torah says, do not recognize faces in judgment. Hear the small like the great. You don't show favor to anybody. Do not fear anyone, for justice belongs to God. You're not allowed to fear. You have to act, and you have to carry out the law. I added in brackets the Hebrew word that's used because it's an unusual word. What's the usual word, Hebrew speakers? What's the usual word for fear in Hebrew? Pachad is one, right? Yirah may be another one. This is an odd word. It is a word that appears in Tanakh, but it's unusual. And the sages looked at it and said, you know, maybe this word is used because it actually has a dual meaning. Le'egor in Hebrew is to concentrate inward, to store something. A ma'agar is a storehouse. So, lo taguru means do not fear anyone, but it's also lo ta'egoru, do not withhold your words. Do not refuse to act because you are afraid of somebody. The obligation is indeed that you're supposed to carry out your role as judges, as law enforcement. Take a look at source number 13 now, because this is going to lead us in interesting directions. Talmud commenting on a judge who's afraid of one of the litigants. When two litigants come for judgment, one is gentle, that's a nice guy, and the other one is harsh. until you hear their words, or having heard their words, but not yet knowing which way the verdict is inclined, you may tell them, I'm not going to address your case. You're allowed to recuse yourself. Lest the strong one be found liable, the strong one might then pursue the judge. Once you hear their words and you know which way the verdict is inclined, you may not tell them, I will not address your case. And they quote our verse from number 12. You're not allowed to back out. Once you know where things go, you have to pursue justice. Now, here we're kind of hedging, because you are allowed to step away before you heard them. This speaks to the fact that judges in the Jewish legal system are sort of a hybrid. They are public / private. So to the extent that they are private, they're able to say, well, I'm not interested in doing this. It's a bigger discussion. But the overall is, this comes from God, and therefore you're not allowed to back out, and therefore indeed you have to carry out the verdict. Are we clear on that? On what it's saying here?
I don't know why they're allowed to back out if they haven't heard.
Right. So this goes back again to them having status as private people. Meaning the fact that a judge's position is sort of a hybrid, it's not quite a fully public position, affords them the possibility of walking away until they've actually started to act. Once you've engaged, you've become a judge, now you can't say, well, I'm just a private citizen minding my own business. But the truth of the matter is that the answer that I'm giving, I think is technically correct. There is a level of discomfort in Judaism with the idea that's called in Hebrew Yikov HaDin Et HaHar, that the law has to pierce the mountain, follow the law, implement the law no matter what. There is discomfort with that. And that's where we go next. I'm just looking at the time and realizing we're not going to be able to go through it in entirety. But your point is well taken, meaning there is a sense here of hesitation, of acknowledging that the fear of things getting worse by you try to enforce the law may actually warrant a change of tack, that you do things a little bit differently. I'm just trying to figure out if we can start the story here. We've got 3.5 minutes. I'm going to start the story. And again, this is a little familiar to people who are at my Samuel class where we discuss this. It's source number 14 from the book of Samuel. And then we'll come back to it next time. The story is this. The Jews in this period, this is the time when King Saul has just been appointed as king. So it's before the first temple. It's basically call it about 40 to 50 years before the first temple, according to most ways of calculating the chronology. The Jews are living under the control of the Philistines. The Philistines are very harsh and controlling rulers. The Jews at this point are not able to have blades, metal blades. They have farming equipment, but they don't have the means of sharpening it. They have to go to the Philistines if they ever want to. And the reason is, obviously, that they won't be able to make weapons for themselves. Well, King Saul has just been named king. His son, Jonathan, attacks the Philistines, kills a Philistine officer. The Jews rally, say, we're ready to fight the Philistines. Then they see the size of the Philistine army, and they run. They flee in every direction. Jonathan then, aided by God, conducts a sneak attack on the Philistines, routing them. They're very frightened, and they start to run away. Saul pursues the Philistines. He declares an oath. The oath is that nobody in his army shall eat today as we pursue this battle against the Philistines, either because he wants that to be like an appeal to God, like you're fasting for God, or because he doesn't want to distract it by trying to take from the spoils. He wants everybody to go after the Philistines. His son Jonathan, who had done his own attack on the Philistines, doesn't hear the oath, is not aware. And in the course of the battle, somebody notices him. There's honey out in the field, and he reaches down with his staff, gets some of the honey on his stick, and puts it in his mouth. And somebody sees that he, in fact, has eaten. Fast forward the story a little bit. The battle is now over. Saul finds out that Jonathan has done this and wants to prosecute him. The people say, absolutely not. Jonathan is the one who's responsible for our victory. He was the one who launched the sneak attack on the Philistines. How could you possibly punish him? And so the question that Saul now has in front of him is, do you preserve the law? The king issued a decree, and it was violated on penalty of death. The decree was on penalty of death, and it was violated. Or do you say, the people are going to riot if I do this? Do you preserve the peace? And add in the fact, of course, that it's Saul's own son, which complicates the matter. So we'll have to start with next week is going to be this issue of preserving the peace versus preserving the law as reflected in that story. And then I want to go into the issues of imprisonment as well as police brutality in the eyes of Jewish law. So Saul is waiting. Well, you could read stories 14 and then you'll see the ending. But we have to still discuss it. But yeah. Cliffhanger, that's right. Thank you very much. Yes. Shh. Sorry? It would have been death. Yeah, you read number 14. You'll see it there.